have to submit to the time limits, but I would like to open the floor for discussion. Are there any questions, any comments, which can be directed? Yes, please.
To thank you. I'm very, very excited about this discussion. I wanted to ask Butch if, because I keep hearing about the, you know, growth based on consumption and on wages, but I see it sort of, maybe I'm wrong, but I would like you to address this issue in a static way, in terms of dynamic. And so how do you look at the issue of basing in growth in actual consumption, but also ensuring future consumption? And I'm saying, you know, because other of the problems that I think was on the table is the fact that the financial system has been growing so fast, and this is partially because of the huge amount of, you know, pension funds and savings amount that, of course, can be moved very easily and very rapidly, but there's also a huge amount there. So how do you manage in this new idea of development system to ensure also future consumption through, you know, savings, and how do you manage this huge amount of financial assets existing?
Thank you. I have a few comments. These were very interesting discussions, and I have a few questions. First, to Jayati, you mentioned that developing countries were ignoring climate change negotiations, and I would like you to explain or expand a little bit on that, because looking from afar, the impression that I had is, on the contrary, developing countries are very much present in climate change negotiations, and in fact, the issue that negotiations are not progressing in a way is not only because there are divergences among developed countries, but developing countries are not accepting the proposals put forward by developed countries. They didn't follow up with the commitments under the protocol agreement, and so developing countries are very much suspicious about the offers being made to them at this point in time. So I'd like, if possible, if you could expand your views on that. Regarding Butch, I may add perhaps another utopia that you touch upon briefly, that is the need to change tax policy away from labor into capital, I would say. That would also create a little bit more of disposable income and more consumption-based growth, right? And finally, regarding Mariama's comment, I agree that the data that I have been seeing in terms of welfare benefits of future trade liberalizations were very limited, restricted to agriculture, and in this case, most consumers in developed countries. For developed countries, it was basically the agriculture powers like Brazil, Argentina. But yet, I was wondering if the current situation in developing countries, particularly in the net food importers, doesn't have to do a bit or part of its origins in the fact the way the trade system is established, particularly the huge subsidies and export credits that developed countries receive, therefore flooding the markets of these countries with cheap food prices, therefore discouraging production in this country. So initially, maybe these countries would have a bad hit, a negative impact, but that would generate dynamic change in these economies. I want to, if you have any views on that as well. Thank you.
Yes, please.
Thank you. I have three questions, one for Butch, the second for Jayati, and the third one for Mariama Williams. First, the last one, Mariama Williams. I'm very much interested, actually, about tax evasion and tax avoidance, which I think is a very important issue, and some attempts are being made through the Obama administration. I don't know if it's for window dressing, but nevertheless, we see the UBS and so on. But I'm curious about your suggestion on the Tobin tax and how that's going to affect tax evasion. I understand the Tobin tax might have some serious implications and in terms of financial instability, if you like, because one would discourage speculation and perhaps even Ponzi finance on the international sphere. My second question to Jayati is, I want to press you actually in terms of the policy implications of the Chinese walls. Again, I'm very Minsky-oriented, and Minsky was very much in favor of the strong firewalls between the various activities of financial institutions. But do you think this should in some way be reflected in the Basel II agreement or a new Basel agreement, or should it be internationally? Therefore, there's an international regulatory system, or we should rely on the national level. And then coming to my dear sort of topic of global imbalances, as you know, we at the Levy Institute and myself were doing a lot of work on the global imbalances. And the global imbalances are a manifestation of what happens in the internal imbalances versus the external imbalances. And, you know, thinking sort of ahead, the present condition in the U.S., which is sort of has been considered to be the engine of, or the motor of global growth, there is the private sector was in deep deficit in red ink, and now has a savings rate of about 6.9%. And there is the government deficit, which is projected to be a little bit over 11%. But if some of us have our way to have a third stimulus package, that may increase even substantially. So if you take the internal imbalances, there's going to be a deficit, which is going to be reflected in the global imbalance, right, the external imbalance. So how do you perceive this to happen? Because after all, the U.S. cannot afford to have such a high savings rate to balance the public sector so there would be zero sort of, or at least a balanced trade, because that's not something that's going to happen unless there is a coordinated effort among all the nations, right? If that happens, then clearly you would expect that there will be some transmission or transformation in the domestic demand of some countries such as China and the rest of the Asian countries. So now comes to my question. What are the policy implications of your utopian society, which ultimately will have gender and class? That's really what I'm interested in. Thank you.
Yes.
Yes, this is for discussion.
Well, I'm glad we're among friends. So I'd like just the opportunity to thank the panel for a thought-provoking presentation. And I have a few questions about translating the utopian vision into an operational response and what that might look like and how one might go about doing that. So to Mariama, I wonder, your last point was quite intriguing. The IMF World Bank review, but through the WTO. Why would you...
Not through the WTO.
Okay, I was going to say, why would you choose that as a forum? So what could you repeat, if you could elaborate on what that exact last point was and where exactly the forum would be, because I didn't think the WTO would have been the appropriate one. Exactly. Good, because I couldn't.
All three of them, I think.
Review of the Bretton Woods institutions broadly. Okay. Okay. Thanks. That was then a clarification. The next question then, I guess, is just that I wonder, in terms of the plan that was elaborated by Butch, the utopian, no plan, but the ideas of the utopia, I wonder, are these a compilation of existing utopian ideas or your own, I guess? Or, so first of all, and second of all, I think in order to make a cell of a different paradigm, right, if that's where we're thinking of going, what about costing the blueprint? Because ultimately it comes down to bottom line. So what would be the cost to nation states given the agreements, international cooperation agreements and other types of agreements, tax, trade, investment agreements, where there would be real penalties, and Mariama, you started to speak to some of those, of withdrawing from some of these agreements, multilateral agreements that member states have agreed to. And I guess the last question, which would go to the whole panel, again, about how to practically operationalize some of these ideas, would be to pick up on some of the ideas that were raised by Carolyn yesterday about upcoming intergovernmental processes specifically related to gender equality, particularly and using things like the Beijing PFA review next year, CSW policy recommendations, UNSCR resolutions, or the CEDAW convention or reviews. So taking the existing suite of what is available in the context of gender equality and women's empowerment, treaties or policy discourse, and actually employing that to lead to some of the outcomes that you're hoping that changing the paradigm of the economic system could allow.
Anybody on this side?
No.
Okay.
Don? Yeah. Thank you very much for the very interesting panel presentations. I have a couple of questions. Of course, I mean, if we are to turn the paradigm of economic development more from export and foreign direct investment led, through promoting trade and investment and aiming at economic growth to more wage-led, income-based led or income-led growth. The question is, of course, I mean, what we also try to do is to have everybody equally, or everybody should be equitably rewarded through either work or possibly through some kind of social transfer. And in terms of policy recommendation, how would you see, I think there are two things. One thing is to help countries cope with the current crisis. What would be the best mix in terms of as we all have talked about, putting employment in the economic policies, and that also set the framework for distributive systems through the fiscal space to also allow the social transfer, right? And the second question is about the pay structure in the private sector, in the overall businesses across the board. As we have discussed, inequality has been increasing across the board, both at national but internationally. And one of the things also has been pointed out by the ILO report has been the fact that the pay gap between the top executives and the amount of money that the average level workers get has been also widening. Of course, the example that was cited was the fact that when Obama administration decided to bail out all these big financial institutions, they also cut, they had to cap how much the top executives could receive. So the question is whether there should be this kind of there should be more oversight as to how the profit should be really be distributed within businesses, maybe might be limited to larger size businesses? That's a big question I have. Of course, that also complicates a little bit the matter because of the decentralization, especially in the manufacturing sector, even service sector. Many a times, the production is done in one country, many parts are produced in different countries, and then assembled, and it becomes a little bit tricky as a question, but I just wonder if this could possibly be proposed. Thank you.
Are there any hands on this side? We haven't had any questions. Well, in that case, okay. Yes, please.
Okay, I thank you for your attention. I try to follow all, but maybe some mistake. Okay, I just totally agree with JRT, Professor JRT's opinion. It's this opportunity, but it's very, the process is very difficult. For Chinese case, we have the one sentence now. So it means a foreigner now, they don't want to buy more Chinese product. So now just want to move to the countryside because in the rural market is the biggest market in our country. But the problem is that households, rural households, the farmer have no money to support this kind of domestic require. So in recent years, the Chinese government just made many policy to try to improve this kind of situation. So first of all, just cancel the tax, agriculture tax, and the second year just cancel all the fundamental education fee. And the third one is try to build the cooperative insurance for rural households. Before they haven't. And all the policies but destroyed by the new policy of the last year, beginning of last year. Beginning of last year, there is one policy, just we just called the new labor contract law. So it means there are two key points of that law. So the first one, just limitation of the low wage rate, and the second have to buy insurance for the migrant worker. But what's the result of this law? So many foreign investment just move. So and then local government just pay the wage for the migrant worker. And the following just the financial crisis happened. But at that time, nobody is sure if there's a financial crisis will happen. So now is some researcher just doubt it's maybe it's not the right time to let this law work. But keep all the policy, the main aim is all the purpose of the all the policy is just want to increase the rural household income. But the last one destroys all the effect of the previous policies. So we just think the which one is most important for rural market. So increase the wage rate, maybe the rural household, the farmer will lose their job, no income anymore. And another one, we just want to keep the low wage rate income, but they have the job. So this is dilemma of the government. So I would like to ask the question for JRT, please.
Yes, now I will give, starting with Nilufa. All of you.
Answer for all of us.
No.
I wasn't actually asked directly.
Okay, if you would like to make any comment, like to say anything, then we can move on.
Yeah. I was just going to say, as this is kind of picking up something that Mariama raised, which is the issue of, yes, everybody recognizes poverty and inequality are bad, but exactly the policies of liberalization and so forth are the ones that were, you know, against poor people and gender equality. I, of course, totally agree, and that's exactly what I was saying when I said the macroeconomics frameworks have to be changed to fit the goals, the ethical and goals of justice and equality. In fact, I would say that they are so, inequality is so, such a, is so, so much at the heart of the logic of the system that we have at this point, that we cannot sort of deal with problem of gender inequality or poverty by doing a little bit of, you know, trade policies that are a little bit of aware of gender or employment policies that create a little bit more of the same kind of employment for women and so on. And that's sort of what I was trying to say. And I think that Butch's comments and Joetti's and Mariama's comments are all along the same lines. So anyway,
we have really reached the end of our time, yeah. But we'll eat into the coffee time a little
bit.
So the whole idea is that I would like cooperation from all the panelists so that we eat into the least into our coffee time. Please. Would you like to?
Well, I have very little to say, so I'll be brief. On the issue of climate change, no, I wasn't referring to developing country governments ignoring it, but civil society in developing countries. Our governments have actually, yes, on this one, been rather aggressive, and in one of the few areas where India and China are in complete agreement in the international fora. But it's really business as usual on an unsustainable growth path. And the trouble is that I think civil society, at least in the countries that I'm aware of, we're rather confused because we see it as a problem. We recognize, I think, the iniquitous nature of the negotiations themselves. But we are falling either into the trap of accepting our governmental positions, which are based on domestic inequality, or accepting, shall I say, the international NGO position, which to me is also unacceptable. So I think it's really civil society in developing countries that we need to address this much more, including in a gender-sensitive way, because a lot of the climate change things have very direct gender implications, including the actions that are proposed. Dimitri's question on the Chinese wall, well, it has to be national, right? I mean, Basel II fundamentally about prudential regulations rather than about limits on bank activities in that sense. And also because Basel is anyway not internationally binding, I think it has to be national. But of course, then there's the whole issue about regulatory competition, about people saying, well, then we'll move on. I would then go back one step further and say, well, let finance fundamentally be national. And we shouldn't be all desperate to attract multinational banks to our country. So I would argue for very strong national regulations on the Chinese wall. Naoko, it's such a big question that I think I better leave it for now, and I'm sure the second panel this afternoon will be able to discuss it further. I wanted to actually ask Dimitri a question, but anyway, which is that on your issue of the global imbalances, where do you see the role of exchange rates? As I don't know if this is allowed to
yes,
okay,
allowed.
Yes. But and then before I finish talking, finally, just on the very interesting comments by our Chinese friend, that you're right that there is this whole dilemma that if you try and do something good, minimum wages, better conditions for migrant workers, you may frighten off foreign investors, and so the race to the bottom is the only alternative. I don't think that's true. And I think it's really the whole obsession with export-led growth which creates that as this either-or situation. And it is certainly true that there will always be a group within any economy, including China, which will say the minute you do something like this, that, oh, see, it's because of that that you've had this decline. But you've had this decline not because you had the because there's been a global crisis and because export demand has actually crashed. And that is a reality that the Chinese economy will have to live with, whether or not it improves tries to improve the minimum wages for unorganized sector workers in urban China. So if it has to live with that reality, it has to think of different sources of demand, and the most obvious source of demand in an economy where consumption has halved as a share of GDP in the last 25 years is to actually raise domestic wages. And one of the means of doing that is through all of the things that you were mentioning.
Dimitri, you want to answer on the exchange rate?
I'll prefer to answer it after you answer my question, but if you like, I would do that. Certainly, the exchange rates will not solve the global imbalances. That's for sure. We have seen that with the changes, at least in the U.S. currency, we haven't been able to achieve a more balanced trade. So still the current account balance actually was growing while the dollar was actually losing its value vis-a-vis the euro. It's still not clear whether the appreciation of the Chinese currency would have helped, because it would have created other difficulties for the Chinese economy. And since there's a lot of importation of intermediate goods, that's not really what I'm not that confident that it would have solved the problem. So to answer your question clearly, I don't know, because I don't think that the exchange rates would play an important role. And you know, as you probably know, I'm one of the believers that there is no exchange rate theory that actually could guide us in any way.
Okay. I guess worse than giving an uninteresting talk is giving an interesting one where you generate a lot of questions for which you have no answers, right? But let me try to at least begin, the first question is about, the sustainability in terms of finance across time, right? I think part of the answer here is the question of how capitalist economies actually run, right? A lot of us have gotten convinced that capitalist economies run this way, that people pull all their savings into one pool, and then you put efficient projects and you take them out and you undertake these projects. I think what this crisis has again proven is that capitalist economies don't run that way. Capitalist economies tend to run on the basis of either governments or the private sector deciding to carry out an investment program. That's where their growth process comes from. And because of that, capitalist economies tend to always fall below the mark of having unemployed resources, not enough resources that are employed. So it's and therefore, of course, the response to this question, which is the role of the state, right? The role of government policy can also be quite irresponsible. Can be quite unsustainable over the long run. But the basic proposition is there are resources to undertake investments, even in the short run, that could be sustainable over the long run, as long as the investment that is carried out, and in many cases the state has to carry out investment that the private sector doesn't want to do, over the long run. And then there are other resources then that can be relied upon. For example, more progressive taxation, which is what Anna brought up. Right? We have been so worried that it's also a question of how to care and feed the capitalists or the private sector, right? In some sense, there are smart ways to care and feed the private sector, and there are unsmart ways to do it. And partly, one of the most unsmart ways is when you're too dependent on foreign capital, which then imposes a lot of restrictions on what you can do. But higher taxation on luxury goods, more progressive taxation, which actually makes the economy grow in a more stable way, are some of these things. Tobin tax. One advantage of the Tobin tax is it actually generates, I don't think it reduces speculation. If you set it the way it has been proposed at a very low level, but it generates the information of who is transferring the resources across borders. This is what happened, that's what they learned in Brazil, right? They imposed a financial transaction tax on all of these, including checking accounts, and they found out the people who had the most financial transactions were not paying taxes, right? So then they started asking questions, and this is one of the most This is one of the biggest potential disasters as far as handling the international private sector is in supposing it was this utopian thing were ever to happen that the Tobin tax was actually put into place. Now, Dimitri has asked this question. Let me start walking into it, right, Dimitri? And so you said, what are the policy implications on gender and class, right, of this, given the global imbalances that I was brave enough to discuss? First on the gender, this is not a specific policy implication. I think that society should eventually move or should progressively move into a situation where the bringing up of the next generation is a responsibility of the society. Okay, so therefore it should be ready either to let the unpaid work happen or to let women then have a choice if they don't want to do the unpaid work, that it's done either by the state or by a market provision. But then, of course, there are other things, all countries are already committed to equal wages for equal work, which means equal wages for equal work for men and women, right? So that's one specific gender implication that I think that would be done. And again, this is subject to being smart about what to do across time when you have to raise the financing for that kind of a role. But on the class issue and also on the gender issue, the issues, the kinds of things that Livy has also been working on, providing an employment guarantee, which, as far as I know, it has been proven it can be afforded, right? This is really the question, this is really the first question that came up, whether it can be afforded or not. But in order, for example, to undertake these things like, you know, making it society's responsibility to bring up the next generation or providing employment guarantee to make sure that the social resources are there, I think the first requirement is a return to control of managing capital flows, right? Managing the capital flows. And secondly, getting out of competition over over the trade market, over export market, by managing trade more directly, right? Because what you're actually undertaking are social costs that would make a country uncompetitive internationally. This is what we meant by saying that you might really want to organize your economy according to the idea that you want to reach full employment. There are other policy implications that go beyond the, you already mentioned the question of the fact that maybe developing countries should pick up the slack in demand, right, in the next immediate period. I always make the point that U.S. unemployment rate, and I don't know how this fits with your forecast, right, that U.S. unemployment rate would stay at least 8.5% unless demand picked up in the developing countries sufficiently to, and this is a recovery as far as the U.S. is concerned, but the unemployment rate has just ratcheted up very high, and you know, at least you know, half of every family, half of the number of workers in every family would be unemployed for a long time unless demand picked up and was rebalanced by demand in the developing countries. So financial regulation, capital controls, and of course then you can then even walk into the more, and this is not really completely utopian, Keynes talked about rebalancing, I mean, forcing these balances through a global money, increased use of the SDR, which I don't want to spend too much time, but this would have quite strong political obstacles to being put in place. I really want to ask to hear your own answer, Dimitri, but let's talk about it in the break, right? I think that's also the questions that were addressed to me.
Thank you very much.
Okay. So first I'll go to Soraya's question. I think there's been a number of attempts of evaluating the IFIs on the issue of governance, right? Democracy participation, there's the Zedello Commission, Metzler Commission. There's only been one attempt to actually examine the impact of their policies on developing countries. And that's internal, that the Office of Evaluation inside the IFIs. What I'm saying is that it is time, given the debacle that both the IMF and the World Bank have done in the developing countries, and that no one has held them accountable. And you read the World Bank, and the World Bank's talking about protecting essential services at the same time that all of its policies is about privatization and liberalization of those services. That it's time for some group, and I was thinking through that maybe a consortium of researchers from different universities in the North and South to actually examine the macroeconomic policies and the development impact of the banks and the IMF program. And I think some aspect of that work have been ongoing in terms of, from the point, not from economists, but from public health sphere, where people have actually examined and made particular recommendation. The other example would be the Center for Economic Policy Research that have actually engaged the bank's work on trade and actually came up with the fact that the bank had faulty analysis, they made algebraic errors, they had double counting when they were predicting these rosy, in fact, climb. Made tremendous amount of algebraic accounting mistakes in estimating the benefits of trade liberalization, for which the bank then had to be commissioned in various studies, which led us to this part where they went from 800 million to 87 million, right? So it's a process of I think, taking that on. And that was my suggestion, that that's a possible area for us to begin to intervene as feminist economists. In terms of the tax cooperation, I didn't mean to imply, I'm sorry if I did, I was kind of rushing through and trying to
get my proposal out for both trade investment and taxation, that Tobin tax would be a cure or even a curb on transfer pricing. Transfer pricing can only be dealt with by actually dealing with bank secrecy, jurisdictional secrecy, attacking the shadow banking system, and all of the offshore current transaction process, as well as a concerted effort by the global community to really define and come up with a uniform standard and approach to assessing transfer pricing, right? The transfer pricing itself is legitimate. The problem is the manipulation of the transfer pricing and the assessing intra-values between firms. And so there are very clear mechanisms that's been suggested, I think, by civil society and that needs to be looked at. What the tendency has been for the is to defer to the OECD, even the G20 in their thing, simply talked about transparency and information exchange, which will not get to the problem of transfer pricing or tax evasion or any of those other issues. And I don't remember another question, but I'm sure there was many.
Thank you very much. I think we are still left with a little coffee in our cup, so but I'd like to thank all the panelists. I think it says this also lays a little bit of ground for discussions in the next panel and the final session. Thank you very much.